This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, my guest is Ken Buttigan, peace activist and author of such books as From Violence to Wholeness, Cry of the Environment, and Pilgrimage Through a Burning World. He's also the co-author of Engage, Exploring Nonviolent Living. Ken Buttigan works with the peace group Pace Bene out of Chicago, and he has proposed and is working on right now a declaration of peace about Iraq. Ken Buttigan, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Tell me how you got involved in peace work to start with.
Well, I was a graduate student in Berkeley in the 70s. I think that was the 1970s, but I'm not sure. It was a long time ago. And I had been led to go to seminary and thought about teaching and writing. And as part of that, I went to work at a place called the Center for Ethics and Social Policy. And one of the projects that we looked at and started working on was the psychological, medical, environmental, political, and spiritual consequences of the arms race. And as part of that work, I visited various think tanks who were giving us the best thinking about how to deal with nuclear weapons in the arms race. And every place I went, I got more and more depressed because nobody could envision a world without nuclear weapons. And finally, when I got to New York City, I fished out of my pocket a phone number of Father Daniel Berrigan, who had devoted his life to nonviolent change. And I called him up and I said, "Dan, you don't know me, but I need some spiritual counseling here."
What did he say?
He said, "Come on up to the upper wilds of Manhattan to my little apartment. We'll talk about it." And we spent 3 hours. It was a glorious, concentrated period where he laid out his vision that we live in a culture of death, and it's important to resist that. And at the end of that talk, and he was facing 10 years in federal prison for his first hammering on a nuclear nose cone. He was facing 10 years, and I said, "What can I do for you? I'm going back to the West Coast, like this graduate student can do something for this guy facing 10 years in the federal slammer."
And he said?
He said, "Don't do anything for me." He said, "Find some people you can pray with and march with." And that little phrase kept going through my head, and I'm saying, "Oh, no, you got this wrong. I'm the academic. You're the activist." But it kept going through my brain for the next 4 months, and finally I acted my way into thinking and found myself into a nonviolence training, and then with a group that took some action at a local nuclear facility, Livermore Laboratories, which is designed 50% of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Spent a week in jail, and that was kind of the beginning of my, in a sense, baptism into this work.
I'm speaking with Ken Buttigan, a peace activist. And someone who is proclaiming a declaration of peace and trying to get others involved in that to end the Iraq War. Let's talk philosophically for a little bit first about nonviolence. The Berrigans and your action at Livermore, in a way, to my mind anyway, are more acts of moral witness. I'm not trying to denigrate at all what either of you have done. But it seems to me more moral witness than practical political leading from A to B action. So for you, is nonviolence a moral witness, a moral imperative, or is it a tool?
For me, nonviolence is a force for justice, peace, and the well-being of all, not almost all, but the well-being of all, that's neither violent nor passive. And this distinction sometimes between the moral witness and the effective strategy has really disappeared in my own experience. I've seen the power of ordinary people make change. For 3 years, I was the national coordinator of the Pledge of Resistance.
Explain
in Washington,
what that was.
D.C. Yeah, the pledge was a commitment that 100,000 people across this country made to engage in nonviolent action if the U.S. escalated its intervention in Central America. And people organized themselves into 400 local groups across the United States before the internet, and began responding, reflecting, acting, taking action. And what we learned in that experience was that we played a very, very important role in transforming that policy in Central America. There's a great book by Christian Smith, who's written a book called Resisting Reagan, the U.S. Central America Peace Movement from University of Chicago Press, that outlines the power that this people power movement had. So for me, the power that this movement had kind of reinforced in a personal way what we had been hearing from people like Gandhi and Dr. King and Cesar Chavez and Dorothy Day and people in this country and around the world that have put the power of active, creative, strategic nonviolence into practice. The example for me, one of the examples for me, is from a book that H.R. Haldeman wrote, the aide to Richard Nixon, who was standing there as in November of 1969, when the last of 750,000 people got on the buses to go home from the biggest demonstration in U.S. history at that point. Nixon turned to Haldeman and said, "Well, I can't do it." And they said, "What?" "Well, I can't nuclearize the Vietnam War." Because that morning he was trying to decide whether to drop nuclear weapons on Hanoi. But Nixon was a, whatever else he was a crafty mathematician, and he could do the math. And he realized that if 750,000 people were marching, there were probably 75 million that for one reason or another didn't get to Washington. But those people thought they had made no difference because the war continued. We only found that out until 15 years later. We're part of a legacy of places around the world and in this country that have used active, creative nonviolence to transform and create people power.
Do you have some examples from the past 20 years?
Yeah, there are many examples from the past 20 years, beginning 20 years ago with the people power movement in the Philippines. And what's often not understood about that movement, where millions of people withdrew their consent from the Marcos regime, and within 4 days, Marcos was on a plane out of the country, was that the bishops in the Philippines had organized 1,500 nonviolence trainings all across the country, preparing people to stand their ground, to understand that being violent in the situation was going to be detrimental and being passive in the situation was going to be detrimental. But there are many other examples in Eastern Europe, in the more recently in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, in the Republic of Georgia, in even bringing down the Hitler of the Balkans, Milosevic.
Well, tell me about Hitler for a second, because he's often, since you mentioned his name, brought up as the counterpoint to nonviolence or the argument that peace activists and pacifists cannot counter. Mm. How do you address the problem of Hitler as far as nonviolence goes?
I think Hitler represents the great challenge of evil and the importance of challenging that. And I begin my exploration of active nonviolence not ignoring evil. In fact, it's so important to recognize the evil that's out there. The question is how we're going to deal with it and respond to it. What's very interesting is there are increasing numbers of examples we can point to where people used active nonviolence in the face of even the Third Reich. So, for example, there was a book in the late 90s that was published that analyzed how when in 1943 the SS decided in the end to finally round up the Jewish men who were married to Aryan women in Berlin, and they rounded up 7,000 men to send them off to the camps. Those women assembled in front of the SS headquarters for 3 days. And what I like to point out is that nonviolence passes through three phases. First, it is ridiculed. Secondly, it's fiercely and violently opposed. And third, it becomes self-evident. And we see a little bit in this story where the first day, the officers inside the buildings and the headquarters there just laughed at them. The second day, they came out and tried to run them off or tried to attack them physically. The third day, they released the men.
That's like the old Gandhi quote that says, you know, first they ignore us, then they laugh at us, and ultimately you win.
Yeah, well, that's right. And the thought for a long time by analysts was, well, they released them and then went around and gathered them up in twos and threes and still sent them off to the camps. This book that came in the 90s has established that, in fact, historically 95% of those men survived the war. I think what we have there is a very strategic example of how at that point in the war, things were very dicey for the Third Reich leadership. And the fact that ordinary people were challenging that, were organizing and assembling and potentially sparking the rest of the population at a time when the regime was at a very, very difficult moment. Can I say that nonviolence works in every situation? I can't say that.
And can you say that would have stopped Hitler from gaining power, from killing 6 million Jews?
Well, I can say this. I can say that if we construct societies that where the training and power of active nonviolence becomes part of our vision and toolbox, we can create movements that can nip those kinds of activities in the bud. Now, would it happen in 1943? No, it would have to happen in 1930, 31, 33 as Hitler is elected. The challenge for us, I think, in the 21st century is to learn where those kinds of interventions, those kinds of movements, those kinds of actions happening earlier in the life cycle of evil can challenge and transform that.
I'm speaking with Ken Buttigan. He is a peace activist, longtime peace activist now with the Chicago group Pace e Bene, and he is circulating a declaration of peace, organizing groups and individuals around the country to oppose the Iraq War, which to my mind is a demonstration of evil by the Bush administration. How can we use nonviolence? How can we use this declaration of peace, for instance, to stop Bush in his tracks, to end the Iraq War, or for that matter, preempt a war against Iran?
This is a great challenge, and we are in the life cycle of this particular war and the life cycle of a movement that has been building to challenge and transform this policy, and even beyond this policy, as you suggest, around Iran, really putting this country on a new footing. How are we going to solve complicated problems? Are we going to use coercive violence, military solutions, the quagmire that creates, the cycle of violence that creates, and, of course, the incredible costs abroad and at home because of that? Or are we going to go in another direction? And the great thing, first of all, is this current peace movement builds on the power and strength of so many other movements that have been using and wagering with this nonviolent power. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we do have a movement that's 3.5, going on 4 years old here. And I like to use the 8 stages of a social movement to kind of understand where we are. And without going into each stage, I think the early stages are about organizing social circles of people who really do want to see the well-being of all. Now, that's not everybody, but the growing progressive community seeing an issue and responding. Then there's a moment of what, and I'm using a model that a guy named Bill Moyer in a great book called Doing Democracy has laid out. He says that there's this moment of takeoff. And really, in a way, when 15 million people marched against this war in the run-up to this pulling of the trigger by George Bush in Iraq, that it really was this sense that there is a movement for peace worldwide, unprecedented, that's on the march.
You know, not to interrupt the 8 stages, but at that, because I want to hear the rest of that, but that moment was a very exciting, promising moment. And then when the war happened anyway, it was so discouraging to so many people.
Yeah, and this is consistent with Moyer's model, because we had not amassed enough nonviolent power yet. We had organized our concern, our outrage. Some of us had just thrown ourselves entirely into it. We saw unprecedented activity in this country and around the world. Moyer would say, yes, and we have not done what a movement absolutely in the end needs to do, which is to alert, win, and mobilize the majority, to lead the leaders. These movements are not about convincing George Bush. They're about helping the society make a choice in another direction. What we did up until March of 2003 was we helped alert people, we organized, we did our darndest, and Bush pulled the trigger anyway. What Moyer's model tells us is that that immediately, often movements go through this where that happens, and we entered stage five, which is activist failure. And it's that place where people say, it doesn't work. See, that didn't matter. One person leaves a movement, she takes two people with her.
I mean, the movement can end at stage five.
It can, absolutely. He calls this a model of successful social movements. He says virtually every successful social movement has gone through this. Why? Not just because we didn't organize in the right way. It's because we haven't amassed enough of that political power, alerting, winning, and mobilizing the majority. So activists, and we enter stage five. We enter the desert. We enter this spiritual place where it's just nothing seems to be working. Everybody seems to be leaving. What happened to what we created? We were in the glare of publicity in the New York Times and CNN, and now Bush has trampled over that. Stage five, it's important to recognize that that's going to happen because we haven't created enough of that power. It's those who stay who then build the real movement. And I believe since February, March of 2003, it's those who have stayed that are building that movement. So now, for example, you have United for Peace and Justice, that is the largest peace and anti-war coalition in the history of the United States, 1,400 local groups. You have people organizing on a very daily basis. And it was kind of into the midst of that that some of us felt there was the need to kind of throw the gauntlet down to the government to say we're coming to a point where enough is enough. We absolutely have to see an end to this war and occupation. And let's take time to organize ourselves around that. Let's train ourselves. Let's knit together. Let's build. Let's go deeper. It's not different from the peace movement. It's deepening and broadening.
Ken Buttigan,
how do we escalate that?
I'm speaking with Ken Buttigan, a peace activist working with Pache Beni in Chicago and author and proponent of the Declaration of Peace. What is the Declaration of Peace? What is this gauntlet that you're throwing down?
The Declaration of Peace is a movement of thousands of people across the United States who have taken a pledge to work for a comprehensive, concrete plan to end the war and bring the troops home and to create a post-occupation transition and peace process led by Iraqis, people within the region, the Arab League, the United Nations, and so on. So there are various elements of this plan that we see. We want to see a peace dividend. We want to see closure of U.S. bases in Iraq, restoring the economic and political control to the Iraqi people, increased support for U.S. veterans of the war, and no preventive war against Iran or other nations. And we've been circulating this declaration, this pledge. We invite people to declare peace.
But the uniqueness of this, my understanding, Ken Buttigan, is not so much the plan, which is a version of plans that I've seen circulating in the peace movement, but the pledge of nonviolent resistance.
Yeah. That's right. If we don't get a plan, we are pledging to engage in creative expressions of nonviolent resistance and action to this policy. And so for several months now, we've been working with groups across this country. Currently, there are 318 national, regional, and local organizations that are participating in building this plan. We have this movement. We have about 350 local organizers across the United States that are doing this.
People can find out more, by the way, at declarationofpeace.org.
That's right. And what we envision, what we've called for, is beginning on the International Day of Peace, which is September 21st, running through September 28th, people across this country will be taking nonviolent action in many creative ways. For example, the evening of September 21st, we're calling for candlelight vigils across the United States, where all of us can participate in saying once and for all, enough is enough. We need a comprehensive withdrawal plan and strategy here. But in addition to that, there will be marches, rallies, readings of the Iraqi and U.S. war dead, ringing of bells, and nonviolent civil disobedience. That's a venerable part of our tradition of saying enough is enough. Dr. King had this great image in his last book, Trumpet of Conscience, where he says there's nothing wrong with a traffic light that helps regulate the flow of traffic. But when there's an emergency, the ambulances go right through those red lights. We have an emergency. And he says from his perspective, the emergency was how people around the world were being inflicted on, with many economic and social wounds because of the economics and militarism in our world. And he said it's important for us to organize and be part of brigades of ambulance drivers that will ignore the red lights of the present system.
What are the brigades of ambulance drivers going to do in that week in September?
In Washington, we are doing three acts of nonviolent civil disobedience that we're organizing. The first is where the war started at the White House, and that will take place on September 21st. We are working with Iraqi vets. We're working with Iraq war vets. We're working with religious leadership. We're working with people from across this country who will very clearly say enough is enough. We need to see that plan, and we'll be engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience there. That's the 21st. During the rest of the week, throughout the country, people are organizing a whole variety of activities locally and regionally throughout the United States. Part of this focus has been on the U.S. Congress, in that while, of course, the war begins with Bush, the Congress has the power of the purse and can cut off the funding for this war and must take the steps to legislate that kind of policy. So we've been circulating this Declaration of Peace congressional pledge, and all throughout August and here into September, people are going to members of Congress, handing them the pledge and saying, we want you to sign this.
Are you getting members to sign?
We've only gotten one member so far to sign.
Who's that?
Sam Farr in California.
Not Dennis Kucinich.
No, not Dennis Kucinich yet. We're still working. But what many of them say is, well, we don't sign pledges. But then we say, but what you do is co-sign legislation. And we're getting commitments from them to do that. And we're getting letters from them saying, we don't sign a pledge, but we're agreeing with the elements of this plan that you're talking about. But more importantly, we're beginning to see even a shift even in members of Congress from the Republican Party as well as the Democrat Party, where even just recently, we've seen a variety of Republican members start to say, well, I may not be in agreement really with the Bush plan, and I'm wanting to see more of a timetable, discussion about withdrawal, whereas even 3 or 4 months ago, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, Shays in Connecticut comes right to mind. How do you respond to the Bush argument that, or Cheney, who said the other day, there are only two choices in Iraq, victory and defeat, and if U.S. leaves, that's a victory for the terrorists?
Yeah. Well, these, again, are the two options that were often presented in this world, violence or passivity. And our approach is not looking at the question of cutting and running or staying the course, but a third way, which is to create a plan in consultation with Iraqis, people throughout the Middle East and the larger world, that helps create a post occupation transition so that there really is a possibility for a transformation of the quagmire that's going on right now. One of the persons I talked to very early in this process was Rick McDowell, who works for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. He had spent many years in Iraq. He had, during the years with the sanctions, he brought many delegations to Iraq. And when he came back from Iraq a couple years ago, he said to his employer, don't call for immediate withdrawal, because my analysis and from what I'm hearing on the ground, that actually, it is too dangerous to do that. Within 6 months, he had changed his position because he kept hearing from his friends and colleagues working, and Iraqis working in Iraq. And they were all saying, this will not change until the U.S. leaves. The occupation must be removed so that the parties who are there can start to work out what the future of Iraq is going to look like. As long as the U.S. stays, that will not be the case. We've got a fire burning in Iraq, and we've got a house on fire, and the U.S. keeps intensifying that fire rather than quenching it.
And started the fire, too.
And started the fire.
Yeah. I like to say the U.S., the pyromaniac's not a good firefighter, what I usually say. But Ken Buttigan, you back philosophically a second. I saw a couple quotes from you that I liked a lot. We have a couple minutes left. I just wanted to have you elaborate on them. Active nonviolence is organized love. Hmm. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the desire for the well-being of all. I go back to the great religious leader, Allen Ginsberg, who said at the end of one of his poems, "While I'm here, I'll do the work." And what's the work? To ease the pain of living. Everything else is a drunken dumb show. When we want to ease the pain of living, we want to show compassion. We want to be in connection. Nonviolence is about connection, compassion, cooperation, creativity. Violence is the opposite of all of those things. Love is that recognition that ultimately we are connected, and we want to create structures in the world where that becomes more and more self-evident. And so organized love is our it's our great, not just an ideal, it is our job description for the 21st century.
And the other line that I like so much, Ken Buttigan, is, you have more power than you think. What do you mean by that?
The job description of a power holder is to make us feel powerless. That's just in their job description. Our job is to realize that we are part of a movement that's been going on for thousands of years, but certainly accelerated in the last century, that in spite of all the evidence, we are creating change. It's only when ordinary people come together and pool their resources that that change happens. And that's what this this cooperative, beautiful power that's at our disposal that we can tap. And that's what I think we have the opportunity to do this year to try to stop this war.
Well, let's get on it. Ken Buttigan, thanks so much for being my guest today. Ken Buttigan is with Pace Bene in Chicago and circulating A Declaration of Peace. The website to go to is declarationofpeace.org, or his organization, Pace Bene, Pace, E-B-E-N-E.org. Thanks a lot.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.